opinion in writing within 90 days. Counsel in the second case may come forward and get ready. I'll just note that we are a little bit ahead of schedule, and we're prepared to proceed unless counsel wish us to wait for a client or anyone else who's not present yet. Appears there's no such request. So I will call the second case on the calendar. The second case today is case number A22-1264, Shardlow Townhomes Association versus Midwest Family Mutual Insurance Company. I think, as counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will then have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I think both of you were in the courtroom earlier when I was explaining the choice of lectern and how to adjust it if you wish. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and introduce yourself and your client and then begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, and may it please the court. My name is James Kovacs, and I represent the appellant, Midwest Family Mutual Insurance Company. The issue on this appeal is very discreet, and so I intend to be brief, or at least as brief as I can be. The question presented here is whether, for purposes of calculating pre-award interest under Minnesota Statute 54909, a written notice of claim must be sent from the claimant. Now, the answer to this question can be found both in the plain meaning of the words written notice of claim in 549, and in this court's recent decision in Elm Creek. The court in Elm Creek just last year in a published decision wrote, only the claimant may demand payment from the notice party under the plain meaning of written notice of a claim. Further, the court said, accordingly, a written notice of claim necessarily requires a written notice be sent from the claimant to the other party.
Now, isn't it true that that statement should be understood in the context of the facts of that case and the issue that was presented there, which really didn't have to do with the identity of the sender or the type of position that the person held or the role, but rather more about which direction the arrow pointed, whether notice was given to the potential defendant, potential payor, or given by the potential defendant payor?
So the answer to your question, Your Honor, I think is if you look at Elm Creek fulsomely, yes, in that case, the notice was internally generated by State Farm, whereas there can be some distinction between notice coming from somebody else outside. But if you look at the language in Elm Creek and the analysis in Elm Creek, it really does create sort of a bright line rule. And what I mean by that is what Elm Creek did was go through and find the plain meaning of the words written notice of a claim. It looked at, for example, what does notice mean? Well, notice is a demand or an announcement or a notification. And what does claim mean? It means a demand for something rightfully due. And when you put that in the context of 549, the court said only the claimant may demand payment of a notice party. And that is the plain meaning of the language, but also when you get to the second part of the analysis, the intent. And I think the intent of the statute is set forth more in the Blair case, but it talks about the purpose is for settlement. Okay, 10% interest is a very high interest rate, and it is meant to promote settlement between the parties and so that the opposing party does not delay. To further that purpose, settlement, communication needs to come from the claimant or the claimant's legal representative. An insurance company like Midwest Family or State Farm, in the Elm Creek case, cannot settle or have settlement negotiations with a claimant's neighbor or a claimant's insurance agent. You can only negotiate a settlement with the claimant himself. So that's why when you look at the plain meaning as set forth in Elm Creek under 549 and you apply it, you get a very clear rule of law that says written notice must necessarily be sent from the claimant or the claimant's legal representative. And so Midwest Family is simply asking this court to apply that exact same holding in this case.
Well, another way to phrase the holding in that case is that the notice must be sent to the potential payor, not by the potential payor. Now, and I noticed that on page 740, the court said, I sort of identified the issue in the case by saying, we are now tasked with determining whether a notice of loss report generated solely by an insurer constitutes a written notice of claim by the insured under the statute. So in other words, it seemed to be focused more on the fact that in that case there was kind of an unusual situation where the insurer was, created its own notice, or the notice that ordinarily would be sent to it, the insurer created it itself.
So a couple of points to that, Your Honor. Again, as I previously stated, I think when you look at the language written notice of claim in the statutory context of pre-award interest, it has to do with settlement negotiations, and only the claimant can engage in those negotiations. And then secondly, if you look at the language of Elm Creek, the syllabus, and I have the language here, the syllabus says, pardon me, a written notice of claim sufficient to trigger the accrual of pre-award interest must be sent from the claimant to the opposing party. Now, if Your Honor wants to make the distinction of it can't be internally, it has to be externally, then what is the rule for who is sufficient on an external basis? Can the claimant's neighbor send notice? Can the claimant's insurance agent send notice? There is no real clear rule or line to be drawn in that situation. If you read Elm Creek for what it says and apply the explicit text in Elm Creek, which interprets the plain meaning of 549, you get a very clear rule. The claimant must send it. And stepping back further, you can say the claimant or the claimant's legal representative, an attorney on the claimant's behalf, meets that same sort of criteria for settlement negotiations. An attorney can negotiate on a claimant's behalf, but the insurance agent can't. A claimant's neighbor can't. So I do think it is important to make that distinction. And I think when you read Elm Creek and the analysis it does on the plain meaning, I think Elm Creek is stating it needs to come from the claimant.
And do you think that language precludes, if we just think about agency principles, master-servant, agent, principal, and so on, in the very general sense, not necessarily insurance agent, but do you think Elm Creek forecloses an interpretation that claimant does not mean claimant's agent?
I think the rule is claimant or claimant's legal representative.
And you probably feel a need to say that because of Blair, right?
Correct. And I think the
And doesn't Blair, I mean, Elm Creek didn't say that, but so does either Elm Creek or Blair foreclose the possibility that a different kind of agent other than a lawyer could serve this notice on behalf of an insured?
I think that's foreclosed by the plain meaning of the language and the intent of the statute, as I've gone over. The purpose is for settlement negotiations, and so you have to have some type of agency relationship sufficient for that agent to pursue a claim on the claimant's behalf.
Well, I'm not following that, because there is a part of the statute goes on to talk about settlement demands and offers back and forth and the timing and it has to be within such a time. But notice of claim is not a demand. Notice of claim is notice of claim. And what troubles me here is you've got 100-some thousand dollar put forward by the insurance company, and later they wind up paying out $680,000. And so they knew the claim, and who's the agent? What makes you so convinced that it has to be when you've got not an individual insured, but a company who can only act through agents? What makes you so certain that an agent, and again, in kind of the common law, not an insurance agent or broker, can't provide the notice of claim within the statute?
Again, I think it goes to the intent of the statute, which is settlement, and only a claimant...
But you're not saying that your client didn't know who the insured was. Isn't
Correct.
That right?
Correct. And I okay. think if you look at the Elm Creek decision, the focus in these is not the conduct of the insurer after it receives notice, but it's who sent the notice. And what I'm getting at is, in Elm Creek, State Farm had actual knowledge of the claim. It assigned a claims handler. It investigated the loss. It participated in the appraisal process. It knew of the loss. But the Elm Creek court said, yeah, but the claimant didn't send written notice. And so in order to get the benefit of the statute, 549, and the large amount of interest, 10% interest, the claimant must meet those requirements. It's not to say that in this case, Midwest Family is seeking to punish the claimant. It's not a punishment. It's they're not entitled to the benefit because they didn't meet the requirements.
And I understand your argument, but what is it in Blair or elsewhere that you're relying that it can't be an actual agent? And it's a whole nother issue of whether this WA group was or wasn't or whose agent they were, and that's a whole nother issue. But I'm just trying to understand, like, where do we ground ourselves if we were?
So, Your Honor, I just have to keep coming back to the purpose of the statute is for settlement. And Midwest Family, if it receives a notification or a written notice of claim from an insurance agent, it can't reach back out to that insurance agent and say, okay, let's talk about this, let's resolve this. It has to go to the claimant. It cannot communicate that way. And we're getting to the second part of this and skipping over the first part, which is what has to be in the notice. Again, if you step back, the purpose of the notice is to facilitate settlement. And so there's supposed to be not necessarily a definite amount of money, but what universe are we in so that the insurer can sort of or the opposing party can evaluate it. Here, we just have a generic property loss notice, which is just a form that the agency has, and it's fired off to Midwest Family, the carrier, which is a good thing, and we don't want to
put that second issue, if there is a second issue, and I think there's a primary issue that you're focusing on, which is who's the sender. Maybe there's a secondary issue, but before we get to the content, the substance of the notice, which would require us to compare it to the notice in Blair, I think perhaps the difficulty is in the different meanings of agent. And we have what we think of as an insurance agent, but we also have this notion of an agent for a corporation, for example, under agency law and common law. So I wonder to reiterate or to ask again the Chief Judge's question, putting aside the term of art or the specific meaning of an insurance agent or broker, but thinking of a corporation that has to work and act through other people on its behalf, an agent of the corporation, an officer of the corporation, is that a claimant? If that person on behalf of the organization sends something in, would you say that's a claimant or an agent of the claimant as we're looking at only the claimant? Quoting Elm Creek, only the claimant can do this.
Two parts. To directly answer your question, like a CEO of a corporation, that is the claimant. They're within the structure of the claimant. I think some type of outside agency would be the corporation has an insurance broker, and the CEO sends an email to the insurance broker and says, pass this along to the insurance company. That would be more analogous to here. But if the CEO or somebody within the structure of the corporation sends a letter or some type of written notice, that would be sufficient under 549. And I want to back up on this whole principle or concept of agency and note that the district court in this case, despite respondents' arguments, found that there was not that type of agency in this case. And the respondent did not cross appeal on that issue. The district court said or acknowledged that the insurance agent in this case was an outside individual and not a legal representative.
So on the specific point of what does this record show regarding the role of WA Group, what can you answer that for us? So as I looked at it, it seemed that the primary role was WA Group acts as an insurance sales force for right. Midwest. They're selling insurance for Midwest. That's how I understood their role. They're not buying insurance on behalf of the association, but selling insurance on behalf of Midwest.
Well, that's why, particularly with insurance agents, the concept of agency is a little tricky because they're in this dual role. They have agency with both the carrier, the insurance company, and the client, the insured, ultimately, because if they don't procure the right insurance, they do have fiduciary duties and certain obligations to the insured as well. So they're in this dual role that doesn't fit neatly, which I think highlights why a clear rule of law is the best way and the simplest way to handle this, and that clear rule of law is set forth in the Elm Creek decision. Unless there are any further questions, appellant would rest.
There could be another clear rule of law that says only the claimant, and then we're going to add and develop the law and issue a precedential opinion that says, or its insurance broker.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that could be clear. So my question to you is, the record in this case that the district court is looking at, in the context of a summary judgment motion, is it enough to say because WA Group sells insurance on behalf of Midwest, the arrow, to use my colleague's term, is pointing toward the insurance company when we look at the applicability of pre-award judgment statute?
And I'm out of time. May I answer this question? Just so I'm understanding, are you saying that WA was an agent of Midwest Family?
I don't want to use the word agent. Well, I'm just trying to say, are they the claimant or the claimant's representative, or is the arrow instead pointing towards the insurance company by virtue of the fact that on this record, it's undisputed, they sell insurance for Midwest. They don't buy insurance right. for the association.
By Shardlow sending a written notice of claim to WA Group does not satisfy their requirement under the statute. I think the best way to look at this is if you look at the sworn proof of loss that was submitted in October of 2020. Shardlow, as an entity, completed a sworn proof of loss. One of their somebody within that organization signed it under oath and submitted it directly to Midwest Family. That is a communication, a written notice of loss from Shardlow to Midwest Family, and that would satisfy the requirements of 549. Having an independent third person in the middle breaks that chain, if that answers your question.
Judge Johnson, could I just... this is just something to think about and maybe respond to during your rebuttal. Is it your client's position that WA Group is not the agent of Midwest?
For purposes of this discussion, correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Correct that what? I'm sorry.
WA Group is a third party, and for purposes of this appeal, specifically the way that the district court addressed it, there is no agency between either Shardlow and WA or WA and Midwest Family. They are an independent third party for purposes of this appeal.
And think about letting us know on what you base that they're actually independent and neither and not an agent for either in the kind of common law agency sort of not insurance broker language. Thanks.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before you sit down, yep. I want to follow up on that. So I know you pointed out the footnote 7 of the district court's order, which concludes Minnesota law does not support broad agency for a broker to act on behalf of the insured. But isn't it one of the premises of the district court's decision that WA was a common law agent representative of Charlot for purposes of this notice of claim. Am I correct? That was the district court's reasoning?
I think the district court said that they were acting on their behalf, but I don't know that they used the term, they are their agent for this. I can relook at the opinion, but I don't think that was fair. Explicitly determined.
Representative, was that word used?
I don't recall.
I can look again. But anyway, but whatever the term is, you would agree that the district court district court reasoned that WA was acting on behalf of Charlot. You would agree with that?
I would agree with that, but I would say that it was in the same context that someone's neighbor could write a letter on your behalf or anyone else, and that's why I think the distinction is important to have a legal representative.
And do you take issue with that as a matter of fact? In other words, was the district court incorrect as a factual matter in saying that WA was acting on behalf of Charlot?
No, we're not challenging any factual determinations by the district court. We're relying on the application of law and that the district court concluded as a legal matter that WA was an outside individual and not a legal representative of Charlot.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Kovacs at this time?
Judge Johnson, yeah. I do, but I can wait till rebuttal, too.
No, I'd say go ahead right now. Yeah.
So if the Townhome Association had specifically contracted with a third-party company to act as its agent, not a lawyer, but you know, a company like they administer workers' comp programs or whatever, but to help it pursue claims and with maintenance, et cetera, and that third party had provided the notice, a written notice of claim to Midwest, would that be a written notice of claim then? A contracted party where clearly they are an agent, but they're an independent third party otherwise.
Right. So first of all, that's not the facts of this case. In your hypothetical, I think it's possible. It would depend on whether or not they could be considered a legal representative. Again, if you're talking about somebody other than an attorney, it gets a little more complicated. There could be some type of third party that is out there with some type of capacity to do some type of representation in pursuing a claim. But again, getting back to the purpose of the statute, this is about negotiating settlements, and that who can negotiate a settlement, the claimant or the claimant's legal representative?
So if I could you're potentially in reading legal representative more broadly than attorney. You're saying it's somebody who kind of fits this legal notion of being an actual agent?
Yes, I don't think that question is before the court, but yes, under this hypothetical, a legal representative could be potentially broader than just an attorney.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for bearing with me.
Now
on
I must
that.
Follow up okay. with one more question. The term legal representative, where does that come from?
The analysis is coming from.
But that term.
I think is it the Blair decision or the Bunomatic? I don't. It's in one of those cases cited in our briefs. We set forth a history. There's three cases: the Bunomatic, Blair, and then Elm Creek. It comes from those cases. I can't tell you offhand which one.
Thank you.
I can on rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Kovacs. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Good morning. Your Honors, Justice Lindell, may it please the court, for the respondent, Charlot Townhomes Association. I want to start out very briefly. This isn't about a settlement. That has nothing to do with this. There's no settlement offer extended to someone
right,
who was.
Right, but the pre-judgment interest statute is designed the way it is because it's related to incentives and negotiating and settlement, right?
I would say that
and maybe if I could, before you speak, you're kind of a soft talker. So if you could either pull the microphone a little closer or speak up a little bit,
I would
appreciate it. Thank you.
Certainly, Your Honor. What I'm saying, of course, the prejudgment interest statute speaks to the desirability of people resolving their differences as soon as possible after they've been given notice that those differences exist. The question in this case is whether or not notice was given, not whether or not settlement talks were held between appropriate persons or who had authority to do that, et cetera. Those are two separate issues. And Blair is very clear in saying that the notice of claim is not a demand for settlement.
Into the case law, it was clear to me from appellant's argument that there's no argument that the statute is ambiguous. There was no argument in the briefs or in or are you arguing that the statute's ambiguous at all?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Okay. So I apologize, Your Honor. So we do have a very straightforward question about whether notice was sufficient. The undisputed facts are that the association worked with Sandy Eastling to report the loss to Midwest. And Sandy Eastling put in an affidavit noting that WA Group, for whom she works, is an independent agency that sells insurance for a number of different insurance companies. So they are not a company that sells insurance for Midwest. They're what you would consider to be a broker. They offer all kinds of different things. You can go in, find what you need, they'll sell it to you.
But they are a company that sells insurance for Midwest.
They are a company that sells insurance for a number of different lines,
including Midwest.
Yes.
It's a correct statement to say they sell insurance for Midwest.
I think it's a limited statement, Your Honor. And I feel like to the extent that whether or not they're a broker as opposed to being an agent for Midwest is important, I think it's important that they sell multiple lines for multiple companies.
Was there written notice provided to WA Group from Shardlow?
To WA Group? I don't know. We would have to dig into the record. What I believe from the notice language, I believe that the Shardlow's manager called their insurance broker, the person that they work with for their insurance needs, and they said, we had this claim, please report it to Midwest, and they did. And Sandy Eastling then emailed back to the manager. This is to confirm I've submitted a property notice of loss to your insurance company. You should hear back from an adjuster. If you don't contact me, I'll call them on your behalf. When I get back the information, adjuster, et cetera, I'll email it to you. So she was working with the Shardlow's property manager. The notice was sent on behalf of Shardlow.
So how do we distinguish, though, what happened here from the case saying, well, the insurance company can't give notice to itself? That's not what this statute is about. It's about parties in litigation, parties to a claim. So
I think that's really simple.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's really simple. Elm Creek is, I mean, right on its face, it's asking, if a notice is self-generated, is it a notice? And Elm Creek says, no. When you look at the statute, what's the purpose of the statute? The insurance company needs to know about the claim with enough information so that they can evaluate their liability and then move forward appropriately. And the faster they do, the less interest is going to accrue. So the question of the statute is, has the insurance company received the information necessary to know that the claimant's making a claim and what the, you know, and enough information to be able to move forward with determining its liability, right? And Elm Creek looked at the question of, is notice a notice when it's self-generated? And the answer is no, and I think that's an obvious answer, no. The notice is not a notice because I noticed it. I don't write a notice to myself. It's something that you receive.
So it seems to me that Elm Creek goes beyond beyond that, because it says in the syllabus, the claimant must send.
Right.
And it says only the claimant. And I think that's the part that I have a hard time getting around. It seems that's that language would compel us to say, is WA Group the claimant? No. And so we're kind of precluded from what you want us to do if only the claimant means only the claimant. So what is your argument that Elm Creek doesn't set up, and I'll put it this way, you could have a decision from this court that says only the insurance company can receive a notice, or you could say only the claimant can send notice, or you could say, each of those is setting up a binary either or. There's two categories, a claimant and a not claimant. or on the other hand, an insurance company recipient and a not insurance company recipient. So if I'm looking at Elm Creek, what is your argument that it doesn't set up a binary between claimant and non-claimant, or that we shouldn't, in looking at this case, take the comments from appellant, and I appreciate the willingness to try and describe WA Group the way he did, because it might not be in his interest in this argument to call them this third party that kind of straddles the line, because if we do have three different groups now instead of just claimant and non-claimant, then perhaps we do need to develop the law a little bit. So what is your reading of Elm Creek? Is it claimant, not claimant? And if so, what do we do with that given a fair characterization of WA Group?
I think so. Two parts. First, I think Elm Creek, when you read the fullness of the decision, is clear that they are not defining who a claimant is. They are defining that notice is not self-generated. So when I think we're elevating form over substance, or we're being really way too persnickety, and we're getting into where we're talking about dicta. I don't think that the form of the words "only the claimant" that's the core message of Elm Creek. I think Elm Creek is...
The syllabus also says the claimant must send.
Yes.
So, I mean, we have a syllabus point for a reason, presumably to...
Understood.
...to establish the rule that then...
Sure.
...future courts would have to apply.
Yes, and that's the second part, Your Honor. So, first part, I think Elm Creek is very clear that they're answering the question of, is self-generated notice a notice, and the answer is no. Second, claimant is not restricted. Under Minnesota law, people can act on behalf of each other. And in fact, many times, they have to. And we have a broad, deep, long history of agency law to understand when is somebody acting at the behest of another. And here, the claimant is an entity. It has to act through an agent. A CEO of a corporation is an agent of the corporation. That's why his or her word is binding. An officer of a corporation or an LLC or anything else is an officer. They are an agent.
Right, but you have a property manager.
Yes.
Who is communicating the thing that needs to be communicated. And the question is, did it get sent to the right person? If we're saying, and was it written, if we're looking at the property manager? So we do have some established, obvious, to use the word I want to avoid, agents here. Well, and then the question is WA Group fit that category, or are they something else?
So I think that's two parts again. The first is an entity has to act through an agent. So claimant cannot just mean literally the person that owns the claim. It has to include people acting on that entity or person's behalf. So then the question becomes, was WA Group acting on Shardlow's behalf? And the answer is yes. Under this record, it's very clear. Shardlow contacted them, asked them to send in the claim, and they did. The second part of that is, under the test, not the independent broker, is this included within the scope of an independent broker's agency duties acting as an independent broker, which is what the district court was talking about. We have there's a common law test. You've got apparent or implied authority. We talked about that in our appellate brief, and I want to pull up the part of my notes, so I'm being very specific. So when you have the association is authorizing WA Group to communicate on its behalf, Eastling communicates on its behalf, and reports back to the association, hey, I've done it, and let me know if you hear back. If I hear back, I'll let you know. Midwest clearly understood that Eastling was acting on behalf of the association, because Midwest sent a notice of acknowledgement directly to the association, not to Eastling, not to WA Group. They sent it directly to the association, demonstrating they knew exactly from whom the notice was on behalf of or received from. And then the association continued to affirm Eastling's actions in giving notice to the insurance company by proceeding with the claim adjustment process, as is reflected in the claim adjuster, I think his name is Dahlberg, in his affidavit, paragraphs 2-4. So the facts of the record show the association had Eastling act on its behalf, Midwest recognized that Eastling was acting on the association's behalf, and the association, following that action, continued to act consistently with the idea that Eastling had apparent or implied authority to act on its behalf in connection with providing the notice to Midwest. So, and I think when you look at the case law, when you look at Blair, when you look at Creekview, which we haven't talked about, but I think is important because it was discussed favorably in Blair, in Creekview, they said an association's insurance manager was the one that sent the written notice to the insurance company. There's no discussion of what an association's insurance manager is. That's not a member of the board of directors. That's not the language they used. We don't know if it's a contracted position because they didn't get into it. We don't know if the common law elements of agency were established with regard to this independent, or pardon me, not independent, of this insurance manager for the association in Creekview because they didn't get into it.
I think the issue wasn't raised by either party, right?
I agree. Yeah. And when you look at Blair and you look at Creekview, when you look at Bunn-O-Matic, what they're asking about goes back to the purpose of the statute, which is did the person with potential liability, did they get the information they needed? Did they know there was a claim? Did they know whose claim it was? And did they have information to suggest the scope of the potential liability? That was what the court was looking at. And there was zero focus on, well, was it from a lawyer? Was it from a person who has a contract to act on behalf of that the claimant?
But in Elm Creek, I mean, the insurance company knew there was a claim. They generated, you know, a notice of loss. I'm not sure I'm using the right term. And the court said, no, that's not good enough. So it's not notice. It is the making of a written notice of claim by a party. So, right?
Well, I would say that what the court has consistently focused on is did the insurance company receive in writing the information it needed to know that there was a claim, who the claimant was, and the potential liability?
And so it's your position that literally the townhome association located next to Charlotte could have sent this and that would be sufficient?
I think if the townhome association located next to Charlotte sent a notice to Midwest that talked about Charlotte and what the damage was and when it happened, et cetera, and then Midwest sent a notice of acknowledgement to Charlotte that said, we got your notice, then the answer would be yes.
What if the association property manager sent in an email or in writing to WA Group, and the WA Group then says, I will forward this on, I will send this on. WA Group generates the notice and sends the notice on. Would you concede that if there's a writing from the property manager to WA Group, because there is a writing from WA Group onto Midwest, that would be sufficient?
That's a layered question, Your Honor. In my mind, it doesn't matter if it was in writing when the association... Well,
but the statute says it has to be in writing. That's why I think we focus on written, right?
Well, no, what I'm saying is it's the communication from WA on behalf of the association to Midwest that is the communication in question, and that matters. I don't think that a written communication from the association to an independent broker, then we'd have to delve into whether this independent broker was an independent with regard to Midwest or whether they were sufficiently an arm of Midwest such that notice to the broker is the same thing as notice to Midwest.
Okay. Well, I didn't want to throw you off, but it seemed like you were willing to concede and arguing even that the association would have to send written notice to Midwest. And if it comes from WA Group, it doesn't count for purposes of the statute. And so my next question was, okay, if you agree that the straight line from the association to Midwest would count, what if there was a line going through WA Group? I didn't mean to throw you off, but it does seem that that's the logical result. If you have a written notice from WA Group to Midwest and you had a written notice from the claimant to WA Group.
Certainly, and I apologize if I'm not nailing down on the distinction that we're reaching. I think that if the association wrote to WA Group and WA Group wrote to Midwest, yes, that's Midwest has received written notice on behalf of the association. I think that satisfies it as long as the contents of the notice have what it needs to have. And I know I'm out of time, so my final point is the contents of the notice are not in dispute. That is not argued in the briefs as to whether or not the judge got it right, that the contents of the notice were sufficient. And if there is any question on that, our notice had more information than the notice in Creekview, so I think it automatically, matter of law, on its face, qualifies. Thank you, everyone.
Judge Johnson, could I ask you?
Yes, Chief Judge Siegel.
Question. So if we were to go down the path that an agent, and not, it didn't have to be an employee of the Townhome Association, but an agent, not an attorney, but a common law kind of agent, could send, that it would satisfy the statutory requirements if this common law agent sent notice to the insurance company. Is WA Group, are they an agent of either party to this litigation? And was that issue ever raised before the district court?
So, two-part answer. First, I don't think that we need a bright line rule. In a case like this one, where Midwest responded directly to Shardlow, we have received your notice, where the undisputed facts demonstrate that Midwest knew that the notice was on behalf of coming from Shardlow. If there was some dispute, if Midwest had never responded, this might be a very different case that suggests that some kind of a rule is necessary. But in this case, it's not. We can see consistent with Blair and all the other cases, when the focus is on, did the insurance company get a notice, not from itself, but from outside the insurance company? Did they get one that told them there was a claim, whose it was, an approximate liability, or the means to determine that? The answer is yes to all those questions. They got an outside notice, and it told them everything they needed to know. They responded directly to Shardlow. The second part of the question is, I don't think that the district court addressed whether WA Group was an agent under common law principles, which is what we were talking about. I think the facts support in our appellate brief. What the district court was looking at was whether they were an agent under the insurance broker principles, which the court said those are ordinarily restricted to you're our agent for buying this specific insurance that we asked you to buy. That's kind of narrow. And we didn't get into or talk about the question of, well, what about just regular agency principles? If I ask somebody to do something for me and they do it, and I affirm and ratify the things that they did, aren't they my agent? And in this case, that's what happened. And I think under Minnesota law, the answer is yes. Eastling acted at the association's behest. They did what the association wanted. Shardlow knew it. Midwest knew it, responded appropriately directly to Shardlow, and Shardlow then affirmed and ratified the agent's behavior by moving forward with the claim adjustment process. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Lindell. Mr. Kovacs, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. And before I get into my other points, just to pick up on where Respondent's Counsel left off, the focus is not on the knowledge of the insurance company. The focus is on the written notice of claim. The statute says written notice of claim, and where must that come from? Because, again, in Elm Creek, State Farm had actual knowledge of the claim. It did all the same things that counsel just went through about it knew to adjust the loss, it knew to investigate, and it participated in appraisal. All of that happened in Elm Creek, and it wasn't enough. And that's the same here. Getting back to the agency principles, the issue presented to this court is whether or not an outside individual other than the claimant can send written notice. We're getting focused on, in this particular case, an insurance agent, which, as I previously stated, is sort of a dual role. And I think, as Your Honor was picking up on, if the association sends notice to Midwest Family through Midwest Family's agent, WA, if WA is an agent of Midwest Family, we have a completely different analysis. And the record is not developed, and the issue is not presented to the court, who are they the agent of? Where is this agency? The question presented to this court is somebody outside of Shardlow, an independent third-party person, sent written notice to Midwest Family. Is that sufficient? And the answer is no, based on the plain meaning of the statute, which is set forth in Elm Creek, and the very direct, clear rule set forth in Elm Creek.
Even if the communication said this is being sent on behalf of the claimant?
Well, regardless of what the communication says, who WA is the agent of is a legal question. And so they could say, I'm sending this on behalf of Shardlow, but if in that capacity they are Midwest Family's agent, they're still Midwest Family's agent. And the phone call from Shardlow to WA to communicate that information is not written notice. And I think that would be an undisputed point.
Well, no, well, okay. I was responding to your prior point about whether an outside individual may send the notice. And right. Your answer is no. And my follow-up is, do you maintain that position even if the outside individual says to the insurer, I'm sending a notice of claim on behalf of this insured, and then even if the insurer recognizes it as a communication from the insured and then responds to the insured accordingly. Even in under those facts, you still maintain that that's not valid written notice of claim because of who communicated it directly to the insurer.
I think the answer to the question depends on whether or not the noticed party, the insurance company, can respond back to the same person sending the notice and negotiate a settlement.
Right. So if the person sending it says, not just I'm acting on their behalf, but I've been authorized to negotiate a settlement, then that counts.
Yes. And if they have the legal capacity to do so, again, attorney being the most the easy example of that, but presumably there could be potentially somebody else who is authorized to act on their behalf in that capacity, then yes, that individual or entity would qualify as representing the claimant sufficient under 549.
But even the property manager wouldn't have that authority to negotiate on behalf of the association. I mean, maybe possibly it's in their bylaws that they authorize the property manager to do that. So I'm not sure about that, I guess.
When you say property manager, are you referring to this case or what?
I'm referring to this case. The individual whose name I'm blanking on who contacted WA Group.
Right. It seems like there's a distinction between person who's authorized to send the notice and the person who's authorized to settle. You might have a property manager who's authorized to communicate directly to the insurance company and send the notice that would trigger prejudgment interest, but that's a different person than the person might be authorized to settle a case. And it kind of breaks down your statutory interpretation, legislative intent argument a little bit.
Well, I think the distinction is we're talking about a corporation or an entity and not an individual, right? If you get in a car accident, you are the individual. It makes sense. You are the claimant or your claimant's legal representative. Here, talking about like an insurance or a property manager or an insurance person, the distinction is somebody who writes a letter like that, a property manager, versus when the insured, the entity, Shardlow in this case, sends a sworn proof of loss. That's a document that is fit for this situation where it's the entity signing, somebody on their behalf, signing at the bottom saying this is our claim. That is the type of thing that is sufficient written notice and that an entity is totally capable of doing if they want to get the benefit of 549. And I'm out of time, so unless there are further questions.
It appears not.
Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. It presents interesting issues. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its written opinion within 90 days. We are now at the midpoint of our oral argument schedule today, so the court is going to take a brief 5-minute recess, and then we will be back to hear oral arguments in the third case after that.
Thank you.